From the Moon Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. The U.S.-Mexico border at San Ysidro was closed for several hours yesterday, the result of clashes between the Border Patrol and migrants trying to storm the fence. The confrontation followed contradictory reports on whether Mexico had agreed to keep migrants until the U.S. could process them. Meanwhile, the city of Tijuana has declared a humanitarian crisis. We'll have the latest after the news. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Sure hope you had a terrific Thanksgiving weekend. Pleasure to be back with you today. Looks like it'll be a gorgeous day here in Southern California. As Hetty just mentioned, in our second hour, we'll be providing you live coverage of the Mars InSight landing. At least we hope that's going to be successful. We'll give you the play-by-play coming up in our second hour. In this hour, a little bit later, some of the most commonly misused words, like fortuitous or factoid. And that's just a couple of F words. Ahead, the author of That Doesn't Mean What You Think It Means on Air Talk. But first, yesterday's chaotic scene at the San Ysidro border crossing. Thousands of Central American migrants recently arrived in Tijuana to apply for asylum in the U.S. The mayor of Tijuana has already declared a humanitarian crisis as the city tries to cope with nearly 5,000 arrivals. More are on the way. Before noon yesterday, as many holiday travelers were expecting to cross the border, a group of migrants clashed with Border Patrol officers. Some migrants tried to force their way through the checkpoint or the border fencing. Border Patrol officers used tear gas to push back the attempted crossers, some of whom were throwing rocks toward the officers. Now, this presents not only a challenge to U.S. officials, but to Mexican leaders. The mayor of Tijuana blasted the Mexican government for lack of support in handling the thousands of migrants. We'll have more on that coming up in our second hour. But first, we begin with our political analysts, as we do every Monday. Republican political analyst Sean Walsh of Wilson Walsh Consulting in San Francisco, and Matt Barreto, professor of political science and Chicano studies at UCLA. He co-founded the research and polling firm Latino Decisions. Sean and Matt, good to have you both with us. Let me begin with you, Professor Barreto, and ask you about where we stand with yesterday's events at the border, and at this point, no good solution. Your thoughts on what we saw?
Yeah, I think what happened yesterday was very unfortunate. It really can be described as a humanitarian crisis, not only for the migrants who are in waiting, but then what happened yesterday with the tear gas being shot to disperse the crowd. It not only affected those who were protesting the decision, but also many others, because it was a quite windy day yesterday in Tijuana, and the tear gas blew all over the place. So I think it's a very unfortunate situation. Parties need to come together and get a resolution to this so that we can resolve not only the humanitarian crisis in Tijuana, but also try to get our asylum process back on a normal route. We do have asylum laws in this country, and we need to be following those.
And we're going to talk more about this in the second hour about how Mexico is trying to deal with this. But your thoughts on what Tijuana itself is trying to deal with, nearly 5,000 people housed in a sports complex and a humanitarian crisis.
Yeah, I think it's unfortunate some of the reports we've seen out of Tijuana of people coming and counter-protesting or demonstrating against the migrants. We have to remember that even though the number sounds large, 5,000, Tijuana is a city of about 1.8 million. So you're talking about, you know, maybe 0.3% of the city's population. And so this is a very large city. They do have resources. And while it is putting a lot of pressure near the border region where the migrants are being housed, it is something that Tijuana can do better on. They can provide resources to see this through and to ensure that the migrants are treated fairly, that they're respected, that they don't violate any international UN or other Geneva conventions in terms of how these people are being processed and treated. And that's what I think we're looking for, is to see that there is some sort of political resolution to this, but in the interim, the migrants themselves are not put in any harm's way.
We're talking with UCLA professor Matt Barreto, also with us Sean Walsh. Sean, your thoughts about what we saw yesterday and at this point, no sort of promise of improvement in the situation for the migrants or the crisis at the border.
It is very unfortunate. This, I think, in some respects, strengthens President Trump's comments with regards to actually having a more vigorous border. If you had a barrier in place where you didn't have people charging the border and able to potentially climb or leap over, you could set up a potential area where you can process people a little bit more efficiently. It is awful for the poor people that are down there at the border being tear gassed. It's, you know, from a Mexican perspective, if there are concerns in Mexico, they could have, should have, and historically should actually stop people from coming into their country illegally at their southern border and hold them at bay. And then if they want to process for asylum into the United States or another country, then let that happen down at the southern border as opposed to the northern border. But what you're doing here is you're going to set up a situation, I think, for some Republicans in this Congress to try and ram through funding for President Trump's border wall proposal and some of his other immigration proposals. So it'll be interesting to see what the lame duck Congress does in the next several weeks.
So you think they'll try before the Democratic majority arrives to do that? Do you think realistically that's doable?
Well, I do think it's doable to ram the money through. Now, do the Democrats try and undo that in the House when they take control? Remains to be seen. I'm not sure actually the Republicans have the votes to ram through all of President Trump's funding anyway. But I do think you'll see some Republicans like Congressman Meadows and the Freedom Caucus that try and put together some bills that actually allow for that funding and some tougher immigration enforcement provisions.
So we had late last week a judge on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals blocking President Trump's efforts to ban people coming in asking for asylum. So, Sean, where does this leave us now on, how the U.S. is going to deal with the thousands of people on the doorstep?
Well, as the professor said, we do have a process in place that deals with asylum seekers. The question is, how many can you take? How quickly can you take them and how can you process them? And I will say that if I think there's concern at the national level, I know by folks in the administration that I spoke with over the holiday weekend, that is if this mass group comes into the country, 5,000, and there's supposedly other migrant caravans on the way from the southern border, is you're going to have a run on the border and you'll get tens of thousands of more folks coming in. So this is really kind of a, do you draw a line in the sand here and say we're just not going to allow for mass migration to come forward or not? And so I think this is where the president is drawing his line. And I think he's going to really put the pressure on Congress, to the extent Congress will listen to him, to, again, fund his border wall and his enhanced Real ID and other security enhancements.
Professor Barreto, what do you think realistically when the Democratic majority comes into the House? What are they going to seek to do?
Well, the first question is what's going to happen in the lame duck, I think, going back to that very quickly. I think they are going to try to get some sort of border funding through, and I think that's going to be a particular battle. It's going to be very difficult. So that's something for everyone to watch on, is to see what happens here in December when the Congress is debating that. Do they get a border funding through? Is it at the $5 billion level? Is it at the $1 billion level? And that's going to happen first. I think when the Democrats are sworn in and have the majority in January, then you're going to see a different set of priorities. They're going to be asking tough questions about this. What is actually needed? What is actually happening to migration and immigration laws in the United States? And not just throwing money at the border, but looking at a holistic or a comprehensive solution to this. And I think those discussions will finally start back up in the House, which have not been taking place for the last many, many years.
Want to get your thoughts also, Professor. You know, President Trump, when he suffered the loss at the Ninth Circuit to his refugee ban, described the judge as an Obama judge. And, you know, Chief Justice John Roberts came back and said there are no Obama judges, no Bush, no Clinton judges. Without calling him by name, taking the president to task. Your thoughts on how the Chief Justice characterized it? Do you think he got it right?
Well, yes. I mean, I think in theory, the judiciary is supposed to be independent, and that's exactly what Chief Justice Roberts stated, is that we have a tradition and a history of an independent judiciary that is supposed to be free from undue political or partisan pressure. And so for the president of the United States to be decrying decisions and calling them partisan decisions really upsets that. He needs to examine each decision on its own, let the appeal process work, and let the judges operate independently. So I think a lot of people were happy to see Chief Justice Roberts issue that statement and hope that all federal courts, both district courts, appellate courts, and the Supreme Court will continue to operate without undue pressure and will continue to operate independently. That's exactly what we need at this time.
Well, and what's interesting, though, whenever newspapers cover a decision that's either favorable or not favorable to the president, they'll report which president appointed that particular judge, because it's sort of an indication. If you have, for example, a Republican appointee who goes counter to the president's wishes, that's notable. If it's a Democratic presidential nominee, it's notable because that is indicative of the likely leanings in previous decisions by the judge. So is it not relevant, Professor, for that to be brought up in the context of a decision like this?
Well, I think that there certainly has been research on that, and the research is quite clear that these judges do have patterns and that there are, ideological underpinnings of the way that they interpret the law and the Constitution. But they also change over time. I mean, we certainly see as justices are on the bench longer, they start to take a more historic and longer overview of what the Constitution means. And so I think it's dangerous to call the judges partisan judges that are just there to serve the wishes of a president. They were confirmed by the United States Senate, after all, and so that is part of the process. I think we want to move away from that type of discussion and continue to look at the judiciary as being independent, and we need to hope that they will continue to operate in that way.
Your thoughts on this, Sean Walsh?
Well, so the president has put forward a number of judges, and the one thing that Senator McConnell has done very effectively is get these federal judges confirmed. And I don't think the Chief Justice wants to see these judges going on the courts being tainted as hardcore Republicans. So it plays both ways, number one. And then number two, you just had a very bruising confirmation battle for Justice Kavanaugh. There's a possibility that you could have one or even two more judges or, Supreme Court vacancies in the Trump administration. And I think he wants to make sure that the integrity of his own court is looked at by the public, and he's inoculating himself a little bit to that. So I just hate to see, I really, really hate to see a Chief Justice feel compelled to go out and defend the judiciary. And the judiciary has its own checks and balances as well. So you have federal judges, then you have circuit judges, and then it goes up to the U.S. Supreme Court. That is their internal checks and balances. And by making political comments along those lines, I think the president tends to undermine a little bit of the checks and balances in the public's eye that the judiciary has. And then, as Mr. Roberts is the titular head of the judiciary, felt an obligation to defend his branch of government.
Well, and the other thing is, when the president dismisses the decision, as opposed to, taking it on the merits, because I think, everyone say the president has the right to come back and say, here's where the judge blew the decision and where I think legally it's wrong. But when he says, oh, this is an Obama judge, doesn't that, Sean, undermine the sense of confidence in the judiciary as an independent body?
Well, it does to a certain extent. And look, judges are humans as well. And some presidents appoint people that have a particularly strong ideological bent. And sometimes the judges act probably a little bit more ideological than some people in the public are comfortable with. But that said, again, that is why you have a circuit. That is why you have a U.S. Supreme Court to balance all of that out. So when President Trump put his moratorium on the five countries that didn't have adequate security measures to come into the country, he came out and blasted the judge for doing that. But what eventually ended up happening was, as you noted, Larry, they changed the way that they put their immigration restrictions onto it that passed court muster, and it eventually went up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And what the president wanted to see have happen happened. And so you shouldn't be undermining a judicial branch that actually has done things from a policy perspective when they are done the right way within the context of the Constitution, because, you know, here today, gone tomorrow. And so I just think the president undermines his own credibility to a large extent by just going out and taking one pot shot at one particular judge on one particular decision.
We're talking to Sean Walsh, Republican political analyst, UCLA professor of political science, Matt Barreto, who also has the polling and research firm Latino Decisions. Coming up, we'll continue with reports that the Mueller investigation may be winding down. We'll find out what the potential is for a prior to year-end release of the Mueller findings. We'll also talk about the latest in Saudi Arabian-U.S. relations in the wake of the killing of the writer Khashoggi. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. We'll be back in just 1 minute. Pleasure to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up later this hour, one of the authors of That Doesn't Mean What You Think It Means. We'll talk about words that are commonly used incorrectly, per se, being an example of that. What about podium versus lectern, practicable versus practical, prescribe versus proscribe, presumptive versus presumptuous, those and more coming up later this hour. Then in our second hour, we will bring you live coverage of the scheduled landing of the Mars InSight landing geologic device. We'll talk about that coming up in our second hour. But right now, it's our political roundup with our analysts from UCLA, professor of political science and Chicano studies, Matt Barreto, and Sean Walsh, Republican political analyst. So there seems to be a growing thinking that the Mueller investigation could culminate with the release of its findings before the end of the year. Let me start with you, Professor Barreto, on this and your thoughts based on what you're reading and hearing. And if that happens, what sort of a table that sets for 2019?
Well, I think that's exactly what is coming out of Washington now. There have been a number of reports, including people who have been notified that they may be indicted or charged, that something is definitely going to be coming before the end of the year. And I think, you know, from the public's perspective and from other lawmakers' perspectives in Congress, that's good. I mean, we do want to see the Mueller probe moving along and eventually coming to a close. And so there needs to be a regular update and bit of information. What's expected to come out of this next round of charges or indictments, I think, start to get a little bit more serious, because now the president has submitted written testimony to Mueller, that is his sworn answers to some questions. And what people are going to be wondering now is whether or not that creates any tension with the other witnesses. Of course, the president doesn't know the other witnesses who are cooperating witnesses exactly what they have said, what they have seen, and what meetings they were in. And so I think we'll be looking very closely at what Mueller does with that and whether or not he has indictments coming out against Roger Stone and Jerome Corsi in particular, are two sort of key figures that may have been involved in cooperating with Russia or WikiLeaks. And so I think those are all on the horizon. That's what we're expecting to hear, and it should give a lot of life to this entire investigation.
There was some conversation several days ago. The Corsi was in conversations over a possible deal with the investigators, but it's unclear whether anything came of that. I mean, you've also got the acting attorney general who can control the release of when this comes out. And Sean, would you anticipate that he might well be thinking about how he wants this to come out, the framing of it?
Well, Larry, you hit the nail on the head, because this is not a special independent counsel that was impaneled by Congress. It was put into place by the Attorney General, and it was the report actually is submitted to the Attorney General's office. Then they can make a determination of what they want to release, how they want to release it, et cetera. I do think the politics of this is such, though, that there's nothing that prevents Mr. Mueller or any of his team from talking after the probe is done. So were it me, I'd put the darn thing out in its entirety. If I were the president, I'd have a rebuttal to it, stick to it, and move on. With regards to indictments, I mean, Roger Stone and Paul Manafort and the other folks are kind of gadflies. We've discussed this on your show in the past. There were a lot of Republican mainstream folks that signed on to the Never Trumpers. And so the mainstream people that have deep knowledge of foreign affairs, national security issues, didn't come on the Trump campaign. And you got this kind of island of misfit toys type people like Papadopoulos who gravitated towards the Trump campaign. So is this going to really damage the president any more than it already has? I'm not sure. Unless there's actually criminal indictments or obstruction of justice charges against the president. I think the politics is bad. Mr. Dershowitz came out and said it's going to be devastating for the president. Again, I'm not sure. I mean, the president's had so much mud thrown on him. Again, short of him being criminally indicted or getting Jared Kushner or somebody else into the mix, I'm not sure it really hits him. The one thing it could do politically, though, is motivate enough Republicans to say, all right, we want an alternative and put somebody up other than a guy like John Kasich to run a credible primary campaign against the president.
You said other than John Kasich, so that would not be the candidate that Never Trumpers would support.
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, Kasich made an effort at it. I just don't think he really lit the world on fire. So I think the Republicans are going to have to find someone that's new and kind of fresh and gravitate towards against Mr. Kasich. I mean, again, he got a lot of media attention, but he didn't get any support across the country, hardly at all from a delegate perspective. So, again, he's not the great hope of the Republicans. But I do think there are other Republicans out there that would be happy to throw their hat into the ring.
Who off just the top of your head, a couple of people you think would be in that category?
You stumped me here for a minute.
That's all right. That's okay. Let me go to – I can come back to you on that. Matt, yep. Barreto, do you think that is a possibility? If the Mueller report gets particularly close to the president, do a significant number of Republicans look elsewhere for 2020?
Well, I think so far President Trump has done a very good job of bringing all the Republicans together under his sort of brand. And that's exactly what he said in 2018, that it was a referendum on him, that imagine he was on the ballot. And very few people spoke out against that. He has done a really good job of getting everyone, including his former opponents like Lindsey Graham, who was a very strong opponent, to come on board. So I think from that perspective, it will be difficult to challenge him because he has become, for better or worse, and mostly worse, the Republican Party. But there are some who continue to speak against him. And I think perhaps on that list would be folks like Jeff Flake, who's retired, who might consider or might be talked into it, and maybe a Ben Sasse from Nebraska. There are a couple who continue to be vocal opponents. And I do think it will depend on whether or not this next round gets into the inner workings of the Trump campaign. So if you have someone like Roger Stone indicted, Trump will say, well, he was kind of a consultant. Yes, he was part of my campaign. But if Stone then turns and says, well, I was in this meeting with Jared Kushner and he was the one who said that the president told him to go ahead and pursue this, then it starts to get scary for him. And if that happens in the early spring of 2019, that's when you might start to see some Republicans wanting to see a challenge and see some new faces in there.
I'm presuming, Sean, that Nikki Haley wouldn't be in there. As strong as she is, as popular as she is among Republicans, you figure she's biding her time for 24?
Well, my turkey tryptophan just wore off. I apologize, Larry. I think a guy like Marco Rubio actually could probably be a strong candidate. As the professor said, I also think Lindsey Graham could have been a candidate, although it does seem that he, at least on the judge side of the equation, has kind of smoothed some things over. You know, I don't know if Scott Walker would want to run for president. You know, he just lost in Wisconsin. Rick Santorum, I think he's probably old news, but he's made noises about that in the past before. So was a Bobby Jindal. So anyway, I do think that those are some names that could possibly come forward, and I wouldn't put it past Jeff Flake. I just think he's very damaged goods with regards to Republicans and how he handled himself partly through the Kavanaugh hearings, and then he tried to be kind of a junior John McCain and criticizing the president, but it just never kind of came off the way I think he was hoping that it would come off. I do think Nikki Haley probably is one of the strongest Republican candidates at this moment. She said she wouldn't run, but who knows? You know, if the president is very, very damaged and the party leaders all come to you and say, hey, look, we'll fund a big campaign, things can change.
You think Mitt Romney might consider, or having just been elected to the Senate, that he's not going to want to risk messing that up?
So I think that I actually talked to some folks over the weekend about Mitt Romney as well, and they are very, very close historically to Senator Romney, and they say he's kind of, I've done the presidential run two times now, and my time has come and gone. So it's not in his heart at this time to throw his hat in the ring.
All right. Professor Barrett, I wanted to ask you about President Trump distancing himself from U.S. intelligence analysis, saying the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia bears responsibility for the death of Saudi writer Jamal Khashoggi, who was killed at the embassy in Istanbul. Your thoughts on where this leaves U.S.-Saudi relations?
Well, I think the first question is where it leaves sort of internal White House CIA relations. I mean, the CIA came out with a report that said they had, quote, high confidence that the Crown Prince was directly involved in the plot. And then Trump says on Thanksgiving Day or the day after when he did his phone interview that he didn't believe that, that there was no conclusion, that it could have been anything. And it was sort of reminiscent of his 400-pound person in a basement was the one hacking WikiLeaks when he said during the campaign. I mean, it's just utter nonsense. So I think the first question is, how is he going to repair those relations with the CIA? They have done extensive research on this to try to, you know, piece together what happened. In terms of the relationship with Saudi Arabia, Trump is, you know, continuing to keep the United States very close to Saudi Arabia by foregoing this evidence. And I think that might just put us in a larger risk of allowing these authoritarian regimes to do what they want. And that certainly is not good for U.S. Foreign policy.
Yeah. And one of the things, Matt, that I was hearing is it's not uncommon for a president to take issue with an intelligence report and say, no, you know, I see. But for a president to come out publicly like this and to take issue with the CIA, I can't think of another example of that, certainly in recent years.
No, it's, I think, uncommon, and most of those discussions are handled internally. I mean, the proper thing to do is to have those discussions. They might be heated discussions, but to have them internally and to have those discussions based on evidence. I mean, I think it's quite clear that Trump is just saying, you know, I called the guy on the phone and he gave me his assurances. That was his response. Oh, he denies this. Well, of course, we're accusing him of being involved in a plot to murder a journalist for an American major American media outlet. And he tells the president that he denies it. And the CIA pieces together evidence, including a phone call from the brother of the prince to Khashoggi, telling him to come to the embassy for this meeting. So I think it's quite clear, and I think it's unfortunate that this played out in the public when it should have been behind the scenes.
Sean, your thoughts on this and the intelligence community versus the president?
Well, a couple things. I mean, the president's never had a relationship good at all with the intelligence community. Let's go fast, you know, rewind the tape and go back to when the president first came into office and information was leaked out either through his National Security Council staff or CIA State Department in his conversations with the Australian Prime Minister and the Mexican President. That relationship has been poor through most of his presidency. When Mr. Pompeo went over there, it actually improved dramatically. Now Mr. Pompeo's at State, and I think it's gone to kind of a neutral tone. Gina Haspel is a terrific, terrific veteran hand. So I don't think that some of the things that the president criticizes the CIA on are going to have long-term impacts on the actual professional CIA folks with how they conduct their business. On the Saudi Arabian front, so here's the interesting thing. It is a kingdom, and there are lots of little princes running around in Saudi Arabia. So there may be a move underfoot to make sure that the crown prince is not the person who actually does the line of succession, that another member of the royal family can actually move forward in that process. And this is a very delicate issue, and it's not simply about selling F-22 fighters to Saudi Arabia. And though we've increased our oil production dramatically in the past decade with fracking, we are still very heavily dependent, California particularly so, on imports of oil from Saudi Arabia. Right. Saudi Arabia plays a critical role in the Middle Eastern stability process. So I think there are ways to punish the Saudis, and there are ways to change the line of succession very quietly from an intelligence and diplomatic perspective, and that's what I believe is happening, and that's what probably should happen.
Sean Walsh, Republican political analyst, joining us from San Francisco. Matt Barreto, UCLA professor of political science, thank you so much for joining us. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Some of the words we most commonly misuse. We'll take a look at that right after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle, and I hope to see you this Sunday afternoon at the beautiful historic Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown Los Angeles. We're showing The Artist as the next movie in our Film Week screening series. I'll introduce the movie on stage of the beautiful palace, the Theater at Ace Hotel. We'll watch the Oscar-winning Best Picture of just a few years ago, a silent film, The Artist, all set in Los Angeles at the time when the film industry is switching from silent to talking pictures. And then after the movie, we have a terrific panel of guests who'll be talking about, including our Film Week critics, Wade Major, who'll be with us, and Leah Lowenstein. That's this coming Sunday at 1 at the Theater at Ace Hotel. Tickets available right now at kpecc.org/in-person. Well, always a pleasure to talk about words that are misused, because I know among our Air Talk listeners, so many are word lovers and become infuriated when words are misused, and many of them commonly are. The new book, That Doesn't Mean What You Think It Means, the 150 Most Commonly Misused Words and Their Tangled Histories, is written by brother-sister writing team Ross and Catherine Petras. Catherine Petras joining us on Air Talk. She was a contestant on Jeopardy. So right there, I mean, that sort of establishes her intelligence and credibility. Catherine, thank you for joining us.
Wait, I have to add a caveat. I came in third. I won a designer watch. That was it.
Well,
so,
see,
I don't know.
Yeah, a lot of that's just luck. By the time you qualified for the show, so that's intact. All right. So I sort of amused. So many of the words are F words in here that are used improperly. Let's begin with the one fortuitous, and you use the Los Angeles Times line as the example of misuse. Perhaps it's fortuitous that Davis signed with the Chargers. So what's wrong with that?
Okay, this is really a nitpicky one. I've got to be fair. People use fortuitous to mean lucky or fortunate, but it really isn't the case. When something is fortuitous, it's something that happened by accident. It's nothing. Luck has nothing to do with it. It came about by chance, but it's not like a wow, that was fortuitous. But nowadays, people have started using it to mean a lucky accident. It was fortuitous, like in this case, that Davis signed with the Chargers. And it's become the informal meaning. And I got to say, this is a really good example of how the English language evolves. It's gotten to the point that fortuitous is used technically incorrectly to such a degree that now it's acceptable. although, like, you know, sticklers will still sort of frown at you. I might frown, for example.
And many public radio listeners were. It's always fun to receive those messages from listeners. You use this word incorrectly, and it's helpful for me. It means people are listening very closely. Another one misused is facetious versus sarcastic. I often hear facetious used as though it's sarcastic. Explain a little bit the history of this.
That was an interesting one because, to be honest with you, I knew that there was a difference, but I wasn't quite clear on it. And in writing the book, it certainly made things clearer. Facetious, there's no such thing, for example, as a facetious smile or a facetious action. Facetious refers just to words, not actions at all. So you could say our example in the book was we had Seinfeld saying something to the camera with a facetious smile. You could say his words were facetious, but his smile cannot be facetious. It's facetious. I think facetious is older. I'm trying to think. Is it older or younger than sarcastic? But sarcastic is a nastier word. I mean, it technically means, it comes from the Greek sarcasmos, which I know I'm butchering the pronunciation of, even though I'm of Greek extraction, which means to strip the flesh from a piece of meat. So if you're sarcastic, you're really sneering. It's a very nasty action, whereas facetious is a little lighter when you're referring to words.
We're talking with Catherine Petras, co-author of That Doesn't Mean What You Think It Means, the 150 Most Commonly Misused Words and Their Tangled Histories. I welcome your input. Which words bother you most when they're used incorrectly? We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. The Frames John Horn alerted me to one on Morning Edition this morning from NPR, mistaken usage of laying instead of lying. And that, Catherine, that's a pretty common one.
Oh, lay and lie is a constant. That's one of those things. And it's so odd because we learned it so much. I don't know about you guys, but we learned it in school. It was drummed into our heads. And I think everybody panicked so much that they're still doing it wrong. And you hear it wrong. I mean, Lay, Lady, Lay, the Bob Dylan song, that's wrong. It should be Lie, Lady, Lie, which doesn't have the same ring, does it?
See, we can blame him then for the misuse, right? Because so many of us know that song.
Personal pet peeve.
Yeah. Go right ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was going to say it's the literally, figuratively problem. When people say, you know, I literally exploded with rage, which would be incredibly sloppy when you really figuratively exploded with rage. So that's just the one that just sets my teeth on edge. And you're hearing it again. This is one that you're hearing so often that, much to my dismay, current dictionaries are allowing it as meaning the same thing. Which,
so,
yeah, it's starting.
So
it's
figuratively,
it's a scary moment in our life.
Yeah, and you never hear anyone say, "I'm figuratively going to explode over this."
No, you don't. But you should. I mean, theoretically, but you don't. And it's becoming. That is an example of what's called a skunked term, which language expert Brian Garner coined, and it's when something is in transition. And you can't, it's starting to become acceptable to say, I literally exploded, but it's not yet there. So you have people, you can't please anybody. If you do it correctly or you do it incorrectly, everybody's annoyed with you. So you just, it's skunked. You avoid it.
Scott in Mid-City, Los Angeles, what's one bugs you the most?
Okay, the misuse of the word fraught. Fraught is an adjective. Too often it's used as a noun.
Yeah, give me an example of misuse.
If someone says, well, this whole situation is fraught.
All right. Scott, yeah, Catherine Petras?
That's a baddie. I'm with him. I think that's horrible.
Seppi has one that really bugs me from Mar Vista. Seppi, go ahead.
Hi, Larry. How are you?
Good.
Okay, so I just wanted to say that one of the things that really irks me is when people say, I could care less, when they actually mean, I couldn't care less. So that's one of the things that really bothers.
Yeah, we hear that all the time.
With you.
Yeah, yeah, and I couldn't care less. No, it's very bothersome that we hear that because it means the exact opposite. All right, appreciate it, Seppi.
What's happening now is Some people are saying, oh, they're deliberately saying I could care less in a sarcastic way. But I say that's ridiculous. It's clear that they're supposed to be saying couldn't care less.
866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Perpetuate versus perpetrate. And you give the example, watch Katie Couric perpetuate a fraud. That's the headline from Before It's News. How is this misused?
Well, this is a case where the words sound so similar that people just get them confused because they assume that one is the same as the other and they're not. Perpetuate means to prolong something. It means you're letting something go on and on and on. Perpetrate is to carry out an action. And usually we know it from crime shows like the perpetrator. So just because they sound similar doesn't mean they mean the same thing at all. They come from two completely different words, too. So it's a case, though, of confusing because of linguistic similarities.
We're talking with the co-author of the book That Doesn't Mean What You Think It Means, Catherine Petras, with it. She wrote it with her brother, Ross Petras. Both of them are writers and proper usage aficionados. We're at 866-893-KPECC, the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We'll be back in just a minute. Word misusage, that's our topic on Air Talk with the co-author of That Doesn't Mean What You Think It Means, Catherine Petras, joining us on Air Talk. Hedy Lyn Hurtis just mentioned one to me, and that is fewer versus less. Catherine Petras, I don't think that one's in your book, but speak to that, please.
That's a toughie, actually, because it's okay. It is in the book, and I'm trying to find it right now very quickly.
Okay,
so
I missed that one.
I can make sure I get it right. Okay, you're supposed to use fewer for numbered countable things. There are fewer than 20 people in the library. And you're supposed to use less for things that can't be counted reasonably. There's less sand on the beach. And you use less with numbers when they're a single or total unit, usually with than, less than 50%. But after all that, it's not... This is a rule that was made up by some obscure English grammarian, Robert Baker. He thought that using fewer when referring to a number sounded more elegant than less. And since then, we've adhered to this rule. It's not technically a necessity, but it's now it feels more euphonious when you hear it.
Nicole writes on the page, irregardless. Ugh, I hate it. And also agrees on fraught. So, yeah, irregardless. Is that one of the ones that through common usage has actually become dictionary acceptable?
Pretty much. That's an interesting one. Again, we go back to the evolving English language, and something that was considered incorrect is now considered acceptable indeed. It technically should be regardless. You don't have irregardless as a word, but it's become such a widely used word that, again, more and more dictionaries are saying, okay, fine, you know, we succumb to the pressure. So it's becoming an allowed word.
Robert, in Valley Village, you have one that's definitely in the book. Go right ahead.
Yes. People who use notoriety as equivalent to recognition or fame, when it comes from notorious, doesn't it?
Yes, it absolutely
correct.
Does.
And it's so funny because people think they're applauding someone or complimenting them by saying, oh, they've got such great notoriety. It's like, what have they done? You know?
Yeah. So if you say, I'm trying to think of the example you give in this one. I think it was about a doctor or something and referred to the notoriety.
Yeah, it was someone who had notoriety in sports medicine.
Yeah, right. That was it. Like, well, you don't want that.
What was he doing to his patients?
Don't hire that doc. Whatever. Robert, I appreciate it.
Right.
Thanks. Let's talk with Carol Ann in Torrance. You had fewer and less was one of yours, but you have another one. Go right ahead.
I do. There are two things that make me crazy. Funner and funnest, and starting a sentence with the word so, which everybody seems to do, and they both set my teeth on edge.
Carol Ann, when I noticed so starting sentences was with scientists using that, that's where I first started hearing that term, and then it seems it's crossed over into mainstream. So, Catherine, what do you think of that?
So what I think is it's a tough one. I find that I'm starting to do it, and I think it's just because I see it so often and hear it so often. And I guess it's supposed to sort of be casual. It's like, so I was walking down the street and blah, blah, blah. But it's there's something about it, I agree with you, that sets my teeth slightly on edge, I must admit.
Julie says writing could have, OF, for could have, and that's something that really bothers her. Let's see. Next we have with us John in Mission Viejo. John, go right ahead with the misusage that bugs you.
I really loathe the confusion of stanch versus staunch.
Stanch versus staunch, that's a good one. Catherine.
Bless you, because that's one of my pet peeves. And very few people are even aware that there's such a word as stanch nowadays, because everyone's talking about staunching the flow of blood. And here we go again. This is another one that now is being used. Staunch is now meaning to stop the flow of blood like stanch did, because people got them confused. And here we go. But staunch is actually being used more commonly now than stanch. And as I said, I think a lot of people don't even know stanch exists.
Yeah.
And I want to make a stanch about that.
Yeah, because I think of stanch within the sentence, stanch the bleeding. That's how I think of that term.
Correct.
And I don't really think of that as being applicable to any other, you know, sort of situation. But staunch is.
But the problem is, people are using staunch instead of stanch now. You staunch the flow of blood.
All right. Let's.
But it should be stanch.
Oh, Nathan in Palm Desert, you have one of my favorites, particularly because I'm always the person when we go out to do a live event who has to correct on this. Go right ahead.
Well, I hear the interchangeable use of lectern and podium when they're. Really different words. Podium comes from the word for foot, so it's something that you stand on, whereas lectern is the stand that you set your notes on while you're speaking.
Yeah, so often I'll go to a place where we do a live event, and the facilities person will say, Larry, where do you want your podium? And I'll say, well, you don't have to move that whole thing. It's a huge. But I would like the lectern to go. No, I try to avoid being that that difficult. But yeah, that's one. And when did those two start getting used interchangeably, Catherine?
That we don't know exactly. I mean, the problem with a lot of language is things just evolve. I think what a lot of the problem is that we no longer know, like, the roots. We don't learn Latin. We don't learn ancient Greek like in the past people did. So if you know the roots, it's clear. As you said, podium, foot, obviously. But nowadays you don't have that. So as lectern kind of came from, you know, legere to read in Latin. We had an example in the book, which I just loved, and it's a sad example, but it was President Obama was giving a eulogy for Senator Ted Kennedy and said, we can still hear his voice bellowing through the Senate chamber, fist pounding the podium, which just gave
he's down
a
on
ludicrous
his face.
Image. Yeah, right.
That's how strongly he felt about it. Nathan, I appreciate your call. Charlie in Torrance, real quickly, you want to talk about patronize.
Yeah, I'm constantly criticized for supposedly using patronize wrong. When I think of patronize, I think of being a patron of something, but supposedly it has a negative connotation. I'm a little confused there.
Actually, you're right. I mean, it does. You can use patronize in a negative sense, like you're acting patronizing to someone. You're excessively going like, oh, you know, yeah, all right. But you do patronize an establishment. You patronize a restaurant. So you're in the right. It's just one of those words that has more than one meaning.
Kelsey writes on the page, farther versus further trips me up every time. Kelsey, how I try and remind myself is just taking far versus fur. Far is clearly distance, physical distance we're talking about. So that's for me, kind of like the pod in podium, foot, kind of the key that I find helpful for that. You can share your favorite misusage on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Catherine Petras, thanks so much for talking about your book.
Thanks so much. I had a great time.
We appreciate it. That doesn't mean what you think it means. The book, back in a moment. Great to have you with us on Air Talk today. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up later this hour, we will bring you live coverage of the Mars InSight lander as it goes through the Martian atmosphere, and we keep our fingers crossed successfully lands on the Martian surface, where after its six-month journey through the solar system, it's expected to do significant geological analysis of not just the surface, but go down a number of feet into the Martian soil. We'll have that for you coming up in later, a little bit later, right after our newscast this hour here on KPECC. Well, as you are well aware, and we talked about this in the first hour, Tijuana is dealing with what the mayor there calls a humanitarian crisis. Nearly 5,000 migrants from Central America are in the border region in Tijuana. They're being housed in an athletic facility there, but several thousand are on the way in successive caravans who are heading to the border region. How is the Mexican government going to deal with this? Well, joining us, a New York Times reporter who's been covering the caravan, Maya Averbach. Maya, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So you were there yesterday. You saw what went on in this skirmish along the border between the Border Patrol and some of the migrants who broke off from the main group and attempted to cross the border. Just generally, what is the environment like for the migrants who are there now?
So we see a heavy police presence and many more immigration officials on the Mexican end just outside of the shelter or the sports facility that you mentioned. I think that there is a sense that there will be consequences for those who have broken the law. The Mexican government said that it intended to deport those who had behaved in a violent manner and went outside the law. That said, those who participated in the run towards the border yesterday are a small portion of the many thousands of migrants who are currently here. And so there are many others who remain waiting here who didn't participate and are now having to see the consequences.
Over the weekend, we heard that the Mexican government announced they were going to deport around 700 of the migrants. Do you know if that has actually started, or can you share with us what that really means?
Well, the Mexican government has been continuing to deport different migrants that it has detained who have belonged to different parts of the caravan throughout the past month that the groups have been moving through Mexico. However, yesterday, the municipal police also said that they had detained 39 people related to the events yesterday, and a portion of those were Central Americans. It's possible that they might be deported, but the numbers are not as high as the hundreds that have been mentioned, or there hasn't been an action that reflects that yet.
Of those that are there at the border, are almost all of them Central Americans, or do you now have a mix of Mexicans as well who are looking to come into the United States who are ancillary in that group?
The vast majority of people are Central Americans, isn't the caravan at least. What we do see is that on the asylum list that people are putting their names on in order to get a first asylum interview in the U.S., there are thousands of other migrants who have come before, and many of those who are in the shelters surrounding this government facility that's been set aside for the caravan are Mexicans from some of the other violent states in the country, especially in the south. And they are also waiting for their chance to get asylum. But from the caravan itself, most people remain Central Americans.
And do you have a sense of how many in the caravan are family units versus men by themselves attempting to come in?
It's hard to say the exact makeup at the moment. We know that the majority throughout the past few weeks have been men, often young men. That said, there's a significant contingent of people who are men traveling with their families or women traveling alone with children, and even at least 30 unaccompanied minors who are being attended to separately. And some of those have already sought asylum at the border.
Let's talk a little bit about what's going on with Tijuana Mayor Juan Manuel Gastelum, who has expressed his dismay. He says the Mexican government isn't providing any kind of humanitarian assistance. He's called on international bodies, UN, to be, you know, to help in this effort. So what's going on politically just within the city of Tijuana versus the national government?
You know, his office has said that it costs them more than $30,000 a day to try to attend to all of these people, and they only expect there to be more coming. They want the federal government to give them funding to open a second shelter space, and they want funding for at least 3 months in order to attend to all the people here, especially those who are waiting to seek asylum, and so have to keep checking in at the border and are waiting their turn to do so. However, there hasn't been a promise from the federal government to provide resources. And the speculation is that that's in part because there's about to be a new administration coming in on December 1st. So many people are waiting with bated breath to see what decisions that new government will take under the new president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador.
We're talking with New York Times reporter covering the caravan, Maya Averbach. Also with us, NPR international correspondent Kerry Kahn, who's based in Mexico City, KPCC alum. Kerry, good to have you with us.
Hi, nice to be here.
So, Kerry, what's going on in the capital over this issue? We heard conflicting accounts. The administration here was saying the Mexican government is going to assist in keeping migrants out of the United States, essentially, you know, detaining them in Mexico until they're processed, and then that was denied later. So, what's actually happening?
That's a good question. We'd like to know. It seems that there's a bit of chaos and what is actually happening, and what Maya explained was this transition period. We're coming to the end of a very long transition period. You know, the elections for president were in July. It's one of the longest transition periods in the world. And the new president will take power on the 1st. This does not seem to be one of his top priorities. He was holding a press conference today about a referendum he had over the weekend where people could vote over the internet whether they wanted to build a train that would go through Mayan villages in the southern part of the country. So this definitely has not been one of his major priorities right now. And so the question is, what's going to happen once he comes into power? And all I can say is I don't know. I can add that the federal government did just send out a release that they are deporting 98 Central Americans from the Tijuana area that participated in the disturbances over the weekend. So, and the federal government has sent in federal police to surround that shelter that is in Tijuana. But with regard to the request that the state government has put out and the city of Tijuana has put out for help from the federal government, we don't have a lot of word about that from either the current administration or the incoming administration.
Well, and Kerry, the incoming president has a difficult circumstance, right? Because you've got at least some Tijuanans who are protesting that thousands of migrants are arriving in the border region of their city. You've also got so much antipathy toward President Trump in Mexico that the president of Mexico isn't want to be seen as cooperative with the U.S. president. So how does he navigate the conflict between potentially Tijuana residents and the mood of the country?
It will be interesting to watch and see what happens. There's a lot of questions there. I don't have a lot of answers for you, unfortunately. What we saw over the weekend, and I'm sure the Washington Post reporter that's coming on can describe it much better than I can, but the cabinet secretary did say that there was a deal in motion, and then as soon as that came out in the press, they backpedaled. There's a lot of confusion going on in this transition team. We hear a lot of contradictory there's a lot of trial balloons going up on different policies that are rescinded by the president-elect, and it's a lot of confusion going on between this in this transition team. The big news right now is that Ivanka Trump might come to the inauguration.
So really? All right.
It's not a big priority on their what they're dealing with right now. What they're dealing with is an inauguration this Saturday. A lot of dignitaries from around the world coming. There isn't a lot of focus on Tijuana, to the, you know, consternation of local authorities there that are pleading with them for help. The governor of Baja California just released a video on his Facebook page saying, we need federal help. Something needs to be done. But again, we'll have to wait and see what is going to happen with this incoming administration.
Carrie, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for talking with us today.
Oh, sure. Of course. Thanks.
Thanks, Carrie Kahn, NPR international correspondent. She's based in Mexico City. Also with us is Nick Miroff, national security reporter who covers immigration for The Washington Post. Nick, good to have you with us today. Your sense of these contradictory messages. I understand you're just back from Mexico City.
Yep. That's right. I just got back yesterday.
Yeah. So what seems to be going on?
Well, as we reported over the weekend, you know, the Mexican government, the incoming government, has reached a deal with the Trump administration called Remain in Mexico that will require asylum seekers to wait on the Mexican side of the border while their claims are processed. The Mexican incoming interior minister who spoke to us on the record for the story, her office later released a statement, you know, saying that there was not an agreement in place. But we need to keep in mind that their government isn't in power yet. And so they don't have anything on paper. But I can definitely, you know, report confidently that this is a deal that they have made.
All right. And what would be the incentive for the Mexican government to make this deal with Washington?
They have several incentives here. One is to, as the Mexican official we quote in the story says, is to prevent the arrival of future caravans. Another is because they're increasingly concerned about the kind of use of force. They saw their federal police being overrun at the Guatemala-Mexican border by the first caravan as it pushed its way through. And then also, you know, they see this as a building block toward what the incoming government has as a broader plan. It wants the Trump administration to support its preferred solution, which is a job creation and development in Central America. So this is part of this negotiation is that they will, on an intermediate basis, accept the Remain in Mexico plan on the grounds that the Trump administration will sign on to their preferred project of development in Central America.
And then what would be required if Mexico agrees to keep the migrants, that would they have to provide financial assistance, housing? I mean, because it could be many months, even years, before the U.S. allows those individuals to come through and be legally considered for asylum.
That's right. They say they have 100,000 jobs available across Mexico, including 8,000 in the Tijuana area, that local business owners have said that they're willing to give jobs to these caravan members while they wait. We can, you know, as we know, most of these are in assembly plants, maquilas, but nonetheless, they're offering jobs and you know, temporary work permits and any other kind of assistance to try to defuse this situation.
Let me go back to New York Times, Maya Offerbach. Maya, if part of this is designed to discourage additional migrants coming from Central America through Mexico to the U.S., you know, given the time that you've been covering the caravan, is it your sense that if the migrants are held in Mexico and they're offered jobs there, that that would be a deterrent to people to coming, that they're not looking to relocate to Mexico? They ultimately want to get to the U.S.?
I think everyone, or the vast majority of people, seeing waiting here and trying to get jobs here as either a backup plan or as something to do while they wait to figure out whether they can cross into the U.S., whether that means that they're on a list for asylum or whether that means that they think they might try to cross undocumented later on.
We're having a little trouble with the connection with Maya Offerbach, but what I heard you say was that many of them, they would see that only as a backup plan to stay and to work in Mexico. That would not be their preferred solution. So, but Nick Miroff, I guess that's what both Mexico and the U.S. would be looking at, that this would disincentivize immigrating from Central America through Mexico?
That's right. the U.S. has been trying to get some kind of deal for a long time that would get Mexico to either become, a safe country for asylum seekers, or to get them, to allow, to have these asylum seekers wait on the Mexican side. And it solves the U.S.'s biggest problem, which is an inability to keep asylum seekers in detention for the duration of their court process, because the system that the president and others call catch and release is basically the result of their inability to hold people in custody while their cases are being processed, and they believe that has become one of the biggest motivating factors for people contemplating a trip from Central America, knowing that they can reach the U.S. border, be in custody briefly, and then get released.
I want to thank you so much, Nick Miroff, Washington Post, for joining us. We appreciate it very much. And Maya Averbach of The New York Times, who's been following the caravan, making its trek from Central America now up to the border area, San Ysidro, where yesterday the border crossing was closed for several hours after a clash between those attempting to cross various points along the fence and Border Patrol officers. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, a Supreme Court case being heard today over Apple and its App Store. We'll be back in 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. We're just a few minutes away from the scheduled descent and hoped-for landing of NASA InSight, the lander expected to explore the geology of Mars. We'll bring that to you coming up in just a few minutes. But right now, the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments this morning in a lawsuit involving Apple and its App Store. The claim that the App Store violates federal antitrust laws by requiring the apps to be sold through the App Store, and then Apple taking a 30% commission on any purchases of those apps in its own store. With us is Charles Duan, who's with the R Street Institute, a free market think tank based in D.C. Mr. Duan, thank you for joining us. I understand you wrote an amicus brief supporting Apple's position on this. How did you think the justices responded to the arguments today?
I did, Larry, and thanks for having me on. I'm a big fan of your show.
Thank you.
I think that the justices had a lot of different views on this case. The argument went in lots and lots of different directions. But what interested me the most was kind of the way that the justices ended up characterizing the App Store. There seemed to me to be two lines of thought on this. The first was to look at it as an economic matter: who ends up paying, who ends up setting the prices. And then the second line, I thought, was much more of a sort of, it feels a lot like a retail store. It feels a lot like Apple is the one who's in control. And those two, so in this case, those two end up coming to different results with regard to this case. If the App Store is treated more as an economic pass-through, then Apple ends up winning because the consumers end up not being the ones who are able to sue on antitrust with this antitrust case. Whereas if Apple is more treated as the direct seller, as the sort of controller of all things, then it seems like the consumers do have a direct relationship with Apple. And that's kind of what the crux of the case is about. What makes it really interesting in my mind is that it really ends up turning on just how much the justices care about looking at the economics behind the App Store rather than just what it seems to appear to them to be like.
Now, you're a free market person, and I mean, it seems like you could make the argument part of the appeal for those who have iPhones, they're making a choice that they want that sort of protected environment of the App Store. They want the Apple ecosystem, that it has value to them. How would that factor into the legal arguments?
Yeah, so, I think an important thing about this case is that it's not about whether Apple was a monopolist here. It is about who is allowed to bring the case. It's clear that the people who developed the apps are allowed to bring the case because they were, because, you know, they would allege that Apple charged them some 30% of a markup, and they were directly injured in terms of having to set prices. The question here is whether or not the consumers who ended up paying potentially higher prices because the app developers set higher prices because Apple charged that markup are allowed to come in and bring that lawsuit. And that's really where the free market angle comes in. Because one would worry that when somebody builds a new technology that, you know, ends up not really looking like a store, not really looking like a distribution system, that you would hope that courts would treat it based on the way that the technology works or the way that the system works. But if the courts end up looking at it as, well, this happens to look a lot like a store, then they might end up imposing various regulations that don't seem really appropriate to that technology. And it would be fairly concerning, I think, if companies who are trying to build these sorts of new technologies didn't know what the legal landscape was going to look like because somebody could come in and just make some sort of argument that their technology looks like something that requires some sort of regulation.
We're talking with Charles Duan, R Street Institute, with us talking about the U.S. Supreme Court, looking at arguments involving Apple's App Store and whether it violates antitrust law by limiting who it allows to sell on the App Store and taking a 30% commission on sales. Also with us, from the Open Markets Institute, an anti-monopoly advocacy group, Sandeep Vahisan. Thank you very much, Sandeep, for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So how do you see this legally and Apple's position?
I actually think this is a very straightforward case. And Apple's success here is dependent on muddying the waters and distorting the facts a little bit. So when an iPhone owner purchases an app, they purchase the app directly from Apple. Apple delivers the app to them and charges them the money. Under a long-established Supreme Court precedent, the direct purchaser of a product, the app in this case, has standing to sue if they had a direct economic relationship with the alleged antitrust violator. In this case, consumers are suing Apple and accusing Apple of committing an antitrust violation, namely monopolizing the sale of iPhone apps. So if the Supreme Court is faithful to its precedent, it would rule in favor of the plaintiffs and against Apple.
All right. And we should just mention that this case goes back many years when the lawsuit was filed, a class action lawsuit back in 2011 by a group of iPhone users seeking monetary damages for how the App Store is operated. And Apple appealed the lower court decision that revived that class action lawsuit. So that's just sort of where we stand now. Based on what you heard in the way of justices' questions or statements today, Sandeep, do you think it likely that the justices will allow this to proceed?
I was pessimistic going into this morning. But based on the oral arguments, I'm a little bit more encouraged. I'm still not certain that they'll rule in favor of the consumers here, but I'm certainly more hopeful than I was at 9 a.m. this morning. I think several of the justices understood that this was a fairly straightforward transaction. The customers are purchasing apps from Apple, and so that should be the end of the matter. And even the other conservative justices who are typically more skeptical of antitrust claims didn't seem to buy Apple's position entirely.
Charles Duan, is that how you saw it?
I do agree that a lot of them saw Apple and the App Store more or less as sort of a retail store that has a direct transaction with the consumers. Now, I think that under the law that they should be applying, there are reasons to distinguish a store from the App Store from, you know, some sort of other retail store. The main concern being that with a retail store, the retail store set the prices. They, they purchase products and then sell them afterwards, whereas Apple is just sort of acting as a middleman here. They're not really setting the prices. And again, I think that gets to the question that really is on my mind of whether or not the justices are going to look at the economics of the problem, or they're just going to look at whether or not it happens to look like a sale, whether or not the transaction happens to look like it goes between Apple and the consumers.
And how is this different, Charles, If Apple is the seller, not the entity passing through and taking a cut, how does treatment under antitrust law differ?
So the basic rule, I think Sandeep alluded to this a bit, is that if a company commits monopolistic behavior, for example, raises prices because they have a monopoly, or charges, you know, too much of a commission, the only person who is allowed to collect damages under a case called Illinois Brick is the direct consumer, the person who actually had to pay that overcharge. If somebody down the line happens to also have to pay that overcharge because maybe that original direct purchaser passed through the overcharge, that person may have been harmed, but their remedy lies either in trying to get the direct purchaser, the app developers in this case, to bring the lawsuit themselves, or maybe asking the FTC or the Department of Justice to bring a lawsuit on their behalf. Under that case, the concern, under the Illinois Brick case, the concern is that if you allow for consumers or further downstream purchasers to start suing for antitrust violations, you could end up with lawsuits all over the place. You could end up with complicated damages calculations. You don't know how much of the damages belong to the app developers versus the consumers versus maybe, you know, some technicians who ended up having to pay, who ended up having to help out people with apps or something like that. It ends up being very confusing. And so the Supreme Court set this very simple rule that only the first person in that sort of purchasing chain is allowed to bring the lawsuit. And really, the question comes down to whether or not consumers are the direct purchasers simply because of the sort of odd situation that Apple has set up, where the app developer is setting the prices, but the app store looks like something that Apple runs.
We're talking about the U.S. Supreme Court hearing arguments this morning in a case about whether a lawsuit, a class action suit against Apple, can proceed. This lawsuit alleging monopolistic practices by Apple over its operation of the App Store, how it limits what apps are there and takes a 30% cut of the sales of any of the apps. You have questions for our guests, you can put them on the Air Talk page, KPECC.org. Gentlemen, I want to thank you very much for being with us and sharing your thoughts about this lawsuit. Appreciate it. Sandeep Vahisan with us from the Open Markets Institute, where he's legal director, and Charles Dwan of R Street Institute, where he's senior fellow and directs tech and innovation policy for R Street. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. I sure hope you're going to join me this coming Sunday for The Artist Theater at Ace Hotel in downtown Los Angeles. In our screening series, this is the first matinee that we've done. We thought it'd be fun and maybe make it more convenient for you to bring your family members. We're going to show the essentially family-friendly film, The Artist. Hope you will be there with us. 1 o'clock Sunday afternoon, the Oscar-winning Best Picture of 2011 takes us back to the evolution of the motion picture industry in Los Angeles. The film was shot in a number of great historic locations, including interiors at the Tower Theater on Broadway, just north of the Theater at Ace Hotel. We'll be in the beautiful historic theater, and then after the film, I'll be joined on stage by people who'll be talking about the history of movies in Los Angeles, some of the great film locations that are used, how those locations are determined, and how the artist was able to get the look so right for its late 1920s Los Angeles. That's this coming Sunday, 1 o'clock, Theater at Ace Hotel, The Artist. Beautiful film in a beautiful venue. We look forward to your being there. Tickets at kpecc.org/in-person. Coming up, we're going to give you the play-by-play of the anticipated landing of the NASA InSight mission, the spacecraft developed at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory right here in Southern California. I know there's a lot of anticipation at JPL. We'll hope to capture that for you coming up right after this news break from Hedy Lyn Herdes. I'm a little nervous. I can't imagine how people working on the Mars InSight project are feeling right now. In less than a minute, The InSight spacecraft is scheduled for separation from the cruise stage that carried the mission over the past 6 months to Mars. And it will continue throughout the next several minutes until the anticipated landing just before the top of the hour. We'll be bringing you the very latest developments and letting you know what is hopefully the good news about this project. But to tell us more about it is a guest who's been with us a couple times in recent weeks on Air Talk. She was at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory here in Southern California for more than a decade and a half, a rocket scientist, aerospace engineer, and also teaches astronautics at USC, Anita Sen Gupta. Anita, good to have you with us again.
Thank you so much for having me. This is exciting.
I'm sure you know a fair number of people working on this, but you were sharing with me that much of the work is done at Lockheed Martin on this Mars InSight.
Yeah, Lockheed Martin was the prime subcontractor for the spacecraft.
So they developed all of the hardware for this?
Yeah, and the interesting thing from a historical perspective is that it's very similar to the Phoenix mission, which landed in the 2008-2007 timeframe.
All right. So at JPL, that's where Mission Control is, just a few short miles from our studios here in Pasadena. Share with us what the hope is for what InSight can accomplish if it lands on the Martian surface.
So InSight is an amazing mission. It's very different from prior missions to Mars that have landed on the surface, which have focused on geology, looking at rocks, looking at the local atmosphere, looking at the soil. This mission is focused on geodesy, which is looking at the interior of the planet, trying to understand its evolution, trying to understand its composition with the series of instruments that it has on board the lander.
And so explain how those instruments work. How far down can it dig, for example?
So it's got a really sophisticated instrument suite. And so the first one would be the seismometer, the SEIS instrument, and it's going to measure vibrations on the surface of Mars. So it's very much like having an earthquake on Earth. You could measure Mars quakes on Mars. And so it's going to do that right at the surface and be able to get better insight into the properties of the interior structure of the planet, the core, the mantle, and the crust.
How did they choose the location where they wanted to land? Because it's not a rover, it's fixed in place.
That's great. It's a lander. So the name of the location is called Elysium Planitia. It's located about 600 kilometers from where Curiosity rover is currently on the surface. And whereas other locations have been selected to understand interesting geology on the surface, this location was selected to be very flat. So it could have a very safe landing, a very solid landing on the surface, and make those measurements of vibrations with the seismometer and with the heat probe.
And do they know what sort of ground conditions that probe is going to have to get through?
So they do have some good idea as to what the composition is like just from all the prior missions that have done drilling on the surface. And they do have good reconnaissance data from the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, which has high-resolution imagery of the surface. So they have a good idea of what they have to get into. And there's a lot of testing which is done on the ground ahead of time to make sure that the mole, which is going to basically hammer its way into the subsurface to deposit the heat probe, a lot of testing has been done on that.
And something very – I want to ask something very basic. So you've got this half-year-long mission – and yet, we've got this down to the minute when the separation occurs, when it's expected to start descent through the Martian atmosphere, to when it's supposed to land. How do they get that so precise?
So we do have very sophisticated ways to measure position using the Deep Space Network and the Delta Doors capability, which tells you actual position away from the planet. And it's really important that they get the entry altitude just right, because if it's too shallow, you can actually skip out of the atmosphere. And if it's too steep, you can actually experience too much heating and too much deceleration and burn up the spacecraft.
All right. So time is absolutely critical here. We understand all is going well, so we presume the separation has safely occurred. We are about 5 minutes away from the descent of the lander. Very, very exciting time. And you know, having been at JPL when these projects unfolded, give us a sense of what it's like for everybody that's on campus at this time.
Yeah, so I was a team member for the Mars Curiosity mission working on the parachute system. And so you're obviously really concerned and hope that your portion of the mission works, but it is a team effort. Everything has to work together in perfect unison. Everything actually has to work exactly right. And so there's a lot of nervousness, but there's also a lot of excitation. And it's probably the most amazing experience of your career to be able to work on a mission that lands on another world.
So what is like 6 or 7 minutes of just the highest anxiety
exactly.
One can imagine.
I'm actually shivering now. And so this particular one is 6 minutes and 45 seconds long in terms of the overall entry, descent, and landing segment.
All right, you're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. We're going to bring you the description of this process. We'll join NASA TV, and we thank them for providing their feed so that we can bring you the description of the anticipated landing of Mars InSight. Hard to imagine all the years that go into one of these projects. And, of course, it's a very high risk, potentially very high reward as well. We'll continue our coverage with Anita Sengupta joining us. She's Associate Professor of Astronautics, Adjunct Faculty at USC, and for 16 years, an engineer at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in La Cañada, Flint Ridge. Back in 1 minute. We are 1 minute away from the entry into the atmosphere of Mars by the NASA InSight lander. Anita Sengupta with us. Just quickly take us through before we join NASA TV each step of the way.
Sure. So this is a atmospheric entry EDL. It starts at about 125 kilometers at a speed of 5.5 kilometers per second, which is roughly 12,000 miles an hour. The lander is encapsulated inside of a heat shield. So about a minute and a half after it hits the atmospheric entry interface, it experiences its peak heating, gets to a temperature of around 1,500 degrees centigrade. About a minute after that, it experiences its peak deceleration.
All right.
Which is around 7.5 G's relative to Earth G's. It falls on that until about 3 minutes and 53 seconds, where then it experiences its parachute deployment. That parachute deploys at almost Mach 2, about Mach 0.7, at an altitude of 11.1 kilometers per second. It then decelerates further under the parachute, where it then drops its heat shield to expose its landing radar, so it gets the ability to measure what its horizontal and vertical velocity and altitude is. The lander legs then deploy. At about 41 seconds before landing, the lander separates from the heat shield in the back shell. At that point,
I just need to interrupt. We're going live to NASA TV.
We were on pins and needles waiting for that because we weren't really sure.
This is wonderful news. This will allow us to give some, if this continues working all the way to the ground and beyond, we might even see a first picture from the surface of Mars.
Wouldn't that be great?
Very soon.
Atmospheric entry on my mark. 3, 2, 1, mark.
Here we go.
So in a few seconds, the vehicle will start sensing the atmosphere. I said 35, 22 kilometers from the center of Mars. And it's going to start to slow down very, very slowly at first, but then faster and faster and faster till to reaches about 7 Gs. I made that mistake on the video. It's actually 7 Gs, not 12. And so we'll still very, very quickly slow down, from 15...
In approximately 1 minute, InSight is expected to reach its maximum heating rate.
Oh, yes.
Plasma blackout is possible during peak heating and could cause a temporary dropout of telemetry. This could last for as long as 2 minutes.
Yeah, the gas that comes off the heat shield as it's slowing down, it looks like a meteor if you're on Mars watching the streak go by. That brightness of gas does interfere with the radio reception. And so it's possible that Marco will lose that signal while it's going through this very hot entry.
But not to be alarmed.
Not to be alarmed. It's part of the design. We completely expect it.
Radio Science reports plasma blackout as expected.
Okay. Oh, wow.
You're listening to live coverage of the Mars InSight landing. It has entered the Martian atmosphere, reaching a peak heat 2,700 degrees Fahrenheit.
Marco Alpha has carrier interruption.
So, Anita, they've lost the signal right now?
Yeah, so during this peak heating event, the temperature is really high. It actually ionizes the gases, and that actually serves as sort of like a shield almost against the radio waves from getting through.
From the heating environment.
So we're in this blackout period of intense heat on Mars InSight. And it could be a couple of minutes here before contact is reestablished. And Anita, you were mentioning there's a delay here of several minutes. So.
Yeah, there's a total 8.1-minute delay because of the speed of light and the distance between Earth and Mars right now.
So what we're hearing actually has happened 8 minutes ago.
That's correct.
All right. But we don't know what's happened. So we're getting all the official telemetry coming in to the Jet Propulsion Lab.
Through peak deceleration. Telemetry shows the spacecraft saw about 8 Gs.
Marco Alpha and Marco Bravo maintain rock.
Radio Science reports carrier detected.
detected, so that means they've reestablished contact?
Yes, it's the heartbeat of the spacecraft.
InSight is now traveling at a velocity of 2,000 meters per second.
Seems to have passed this very critical point of peak heating and peak deceleration.
This means the heat shield has performed well.
And the parachute deploys in about a minute, yeah. I believe, yeah.
And you can see that on our timeline on the bottom of the screen. The next event is parachute deploy.
InSight is now traveling at 1,000 meters per second.
Very close.
Once InSight slows to about 400 meters per second, it will deploy its 12-meter diameter supersonic parachute. The parachute will deploy nominally at about Mach 1.7.
And the parachute is what you worked on, Anita, on the previous...
Yes, for the Curiosity. Yeah.
Standing by for parachute deploy.
And so the carrier signal will actually show the deployment event.
Standing by. You're listening to live coverage, Mars InSight.
Radio Science reports sudden change in Doppler.
That means the parachute.
Ground stations are observing signals consistent with parachute deploy.
Good news.
Marco yes. Alpha, Marco Bravo, maintain lock status.
Telemetry shows parachute deployment, radar powered on.
That means the parachute's gotten through its most difficult stage.
Heat shield separation commanded.
Are the legs coming out soon here?
Yes, very soon. I can hear my own heartbeat going.
So exciting.
This and the radar, really radar to so be activated far. As well.
That's fantastic.
I'm on pins and needles.
We're about 2 minutes away from anticipated touchdown.
We have radar activation where the radar is beginning to search for the ground. Once the radar locks on the ground and InSight is about 1 kilometer above the surface, the lander will separate from the back shell and begin terminal descent using its 12 descent engines.
You're listening to live coverage. NASA's InSight Mars lander is we anticipate the landing within about a minute.
So the radar, once it's locked, will give indications of horizontal velocity, vertical velocity, and altitude.
Anita Sengupta joining us on
Earth. The radar has locked on the ground.
Yes. It landed?
No, the radar locked.
Radar now, locked, okay.
That will help it fly.
Standing to... by for lander separation.
Carrier interruption on Marco Alpha and Marco Bravo.
Now it's doing its final descent on its retro rockets towards the ground.
Lander separation commanded. Yes. Altitude 600 meters. Gravity turn, altitude 400 meters.
Oh. We're getting there.
300 meters. 200 meters, 80 meters, 60 meters, 50 meters, constant velocity, 37 meters, 30 meters, 20 meters, 17 meters, standing by for touchdown.
We're listening for NASA's...
Touchdown confirmed.
Excellent. Oh. See, it worked.
Wow.
So exciting.
Great news. I'm watching on NASA TV at JPL in La Cañada, Flint Ridge, where the members of the mission control team are hugging and high-fiving each other. Months of anticipation over this, and for the crews at Lockheed Martin, years in the process of building the InSight spacecraft. So this very, very exciting.
So at touchdown, the carrier signal was shifted to go to a different frequency, so if that happened, they were able to confirm that it landed on the ground.
Okay, so it is confirmed at this point.
Yes, that is
because we had heard there might not be confirmation for several minutes.
So the carrier signal shift would be the confirmation. It's sort of like a binary thing going from one frequency to another frequency. Next would, of course, be getting the telemetry back and then getting an image from the surface.
And that we expect we could get an image within the next few minutes?
So with the Marco CubeSats, which are being used for the telecom relay, those could come within the next 10 to 20 minutes. And then images from MRO and Mars Odyssey would come several hours later.
All right. So, again, the first image couldn't come any earlier than about 12:04 our time, but expected after that. This is terrific, terrific news. So now this doesn't tell us about the lander and whether it's ready to actually function and do its geologic work. But it sounds like since everything, you know, went according to schedule, that the likelihood that the lander would be intact. And
oh, absolutely.
Work, yeah.
So now it has to deploy its solar panels so it has power on the surface. And then the team has to check out the spacecraft or the lander to make sure everything's healthy. And then it would start its science mission several days later or weeks later.
So the images that come back, what are some of the things that it's going to be, will it be looking off into the distance you anticipate, as well as the immediate area where the legs, the three legs of the craft are?
Yes, yeah, so it has different cameras on board. Some of them are sort of for near field imaging to make the best assessment as to where they're going to place the mole, which is the heat probe, and where they're going to place the seismometer. And other ones are to assess the health of the lander, to make sure what the top deck looks like, and then also to assess what the overall geography in the region looks like.
How hard did it land? When it landed on the surface, and how do they protect it from any damage?
So the final descent speed was about 2.4 meters per second, so that's about, you know, 5 miles an hour roughly. So it's pretty slow. The legs do have some energy absorption associated with them. So at that point, you know, the load that it experiences is quite low.
Like shock absorbers to pick up to pick up on that. And then the actual science of the project, what's their schedule when they start digging?
So first, they have to make sure that everything's safe on the lander in terms of everything functioning properly. They have to deploy the solar panels, which will happen within basically the next, I think, about, you know, half an hour or so, so they have enough power. And then they'll actually do some reconnaissance to say where is the right place to put the mole, where is the right place to put the seismometer. So that's probably, I'm going to guess, you know, maybe a couple of days to a few weeks away from doing that.
Where do you see the success of the landing fitting into the overall Mars missions of NASA?
So robotic entry, descent, and landing on Mars is critical to be able to get that as refined as possible, have the most best predictions as possible to facilitate future human exploration. But then the mission between Phoenix and Mars 2020 hopefully would be a Mars sample return mission. So each time we do an entry, descent, and landing on Mars, we learn more about the atmospheric properties. We learn more about dust, for example. This particular lander has landed in dust season, which allows us to have a better set of engineering tools going forward because they have become validated. And it gives us more confidence in our design approaches as well.
All right. Thank you so much, Anita, for being with us again and talking us through it. I see how excited you all are. But for you, someone who knows so many of the members of the team and worked at JPL for more than a decade and a half, it's got to feel great.
If there's one additional thing I can say is that this particular mission carried a pair of CubeSats. They're called Marco. And so they were experimental CubeSats, technology demonstration, to be able to use small satellites to do EDL telecommunications. And so it appears as though those have worked as well. So that was a success and brand new technology.
And what's the advantage of that?
Because CubeSats are very inexpensive. They're very lightweight, very small footprint. So if you can carry your own communications relay satellites on board with you instead of having a separate spacecraft like Mars Reconnaissance Orbit or Mars Odyssey, it also serves as a backup in the event that you have a problem with one of those large assets. You carry your own small little
radios. You transmit right from the surface directly. Yep. All right. Anita Sengupta with us. Thank you so much for joining us on Air Talk. Our congratulations to JPL. Have a great day.